originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. So I want to take a brief moment to talk about something very near and dear to my heart, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. As y'all know, a portion of the proceeds go to the PDJF. I was one of the lucky ones. I'm a retired jockey. I was able to walk away. Not everyone is so fortunate. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Folks, if you're able to help, please visit their website. That's www.pdjf.org. So I am very excited about this evening's guest. He's a native of West Virginia and the son of a jockey. He had a long and illustrious career that included 2 victories aboard the Great Ruffian, a third place finish in the 86 Kentucky Derby with Broadbrush. In total, he's won 3,545 races, and his mounts have earned over $37 million in earnings. It is an honor to introduce jockey Vincent Jimbo Bricelli. Jimbo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Jimbo, I'm so excited to have you on this evening. I've known you quite a while. You currently train horses in Maryland, and of course, I knew you there when I rode. Jimbo, tell me how you got started in this great sport.
I was sort of raised in it. My father rode. My mother was a mutual clerk, and we probably only lived maybe 100 yards from the starting gate at Shenandoah Downs in the trailer park. And I should say there's about 5 boys and girls that came out of that trailer park that made it to the Kentucky Derby and are doing real good. The 2 service boys, Eddie Please's wife, myself, and it's really exciting that we all grew up together. We're all so close to the track.
Wow.
From a young age, we'd go over and watch the races every night. You know, they'd say 2 minutes to post, we'd all run over, get on the, you know, stand up at the gate and watch the race and, you know, run back and play football or whatever.
So from a very young age, you were surrounded by it, and your dad rode, as you mentioned. Do you remember as a young boy watching your dad ride and win, and maybe you thought to yourself, I want to do that one day?
He was kind of getting older when I was at the age to remember, but I do remember him riding some. And I don't know if his riding excited me. It was just the whole atmosphere there. A lot of jocks and their families, we all grew up together, and it was just, I don't know, it got to be something I wanted to try anyway.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have 3 sisters, and they never got into horse racing. One's a nurse, one's a lawyer. So they've all done well, but my dad really at the time, back in the 60s, really didn't let the girls go on the track like he did me.
Right. Right. And do you remember working around the track, working with the horses at a young age?
Oh, yeah, we started early. You know, a bunch of us, as soon as we could get our workers' papers at 14, we had a job over there in the summer. And, you know, the last few years in high school, I could gallop horses till 10 o'clock and then go to school, finish high school and all that. And pretty much all of us did. Back then you had to work. Families didn't have a whole lot. I mean, we didn't starve to death, but everybody had to buck in there.
Tell me about Shenandoah Downs. I obviously it's no longer here, so I've never been there. So tell me about that track.
One of the most beautiful racetracks you'll ever see. It was a small 5/8-mile track, 3.5 furlong races, 5.5, real quick, real fast, tough bull ring. But the grounds were beautiful. They were immaculate. They kept them beautiful all the time. And on two or three times a year, they would run an 18 race card on Memorial Day, Labor Day. And they used to get really, really good crowds. And, you know, a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
And that was located on...
I always tell the story. They had a wishing well as people came in. They would throw pennies or nickels or dimes into this wishing well, hope to do good. Or if they were leaving and they did good, they, you know, threw their coins in. And on Sunday morning, me and a couple of my buddies in the summer especially, 7 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, we'd be diving in there, getting all the change and running like hell.
You sound like a mischievous young boy, Jimbo.
I was. I think to be a jock, you have to be that way.
I think so. I think you're right.
It's in your nature. It's in your nature.
Wow. I heard a rumor you rode a pony race when you were 5.
Yeah, 5 years old, they had a county fair at Shenandoah Downs. And we always had, you know, I grew up riding every day, ponies. And I rode my first race at 5. I didn't do that good, but later on, I won the race 2 or 3 times.
Well, good. 5 years old. That's, I don't know what I was doing when I was 5, but it certainly was not riding pony races, I can tell you that much. Wow.
Well, back then, you know, when we grew up, you know, you get kicked out of the house when it's daylight and just make sure you're in before dark. And we all had ponies and we rode them to the swimming pool and rode them back. And then we had carts and 5 or 6 people got on the carts and we went everywhere with them. And it was pretty safe back then. Everybody was comfortable and everybody was looking out for you.
Yeah. So you were, from a very young age, up on the back of a horse. So riding must have just come natural to you.
Well, I was lucky. I was a pretty good athlete. I was good in baseball. I wasn't too good in football because I wasn't big enough by the time we got to high school, but I wrestled and did really good. I ran track and did good. Our school used to make all the boys participate in as many sports as they could get you to go out for because it was a small school. And I think the camaraderie and coaching I had meant a lot.
Sure, prepared you for what you went on to do later on. Now, I also heard that you were such a good wrestler. You did so well at wrestling that you you had the opportunity to go to college on a wrestling scholarship.
Well, my senior year, I had pretty good many scholarships to go to different schools, and I was probably ready to ride for about a year. But my dad wanted me to graduate, and I guess it was like August. He said, well, why don't you start riding? You know, it looks like you're going to do okay. If you want to ride, you can ride. If you're not going to do okay, college starts in September, and you can go wherever you want to go. So I got lucky pretty early, and it worked out for me anyway.
Say
sometimes
it.
Sometimes I wish, nowadays, I wish maybe I would have went to college, but you can't look back and have second thoughts.
No. No, Jimbo, I think you definitely made the right choice. And as you said, you quickly took off. And where did you ride your first race?
Shenandoah Downs.
You were home.
Shenandoah Downs. I don't know how many I rode before I won one, but I don't know. It was a week or two, and seemed like everybody wanted to give me a chance. So I went with it. And after a few months there, had a top agent call him from Maryland. Asked my dad if he could take me to the races. And I had to stay. My dad made me stay another month. He didn't think I was ready.
He wanted you to get more experience at the bull ring, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Do you think that was good for you, starting out at a bull ring like that?
Well, people don't realize at the time, there were 6 or 7 or 8 really good riders there. They were older. They were willing to explain and teach. And I think it really helped. I kind of changed my philosophy after I left there, but you really get tied on. Everything's happening real fast, faster than on a mile track, and your reaction time becomes real good. So I think those 2 or 3 months I stayed there was really beneficial.
Who were some of the riders? You mentioned some of the older riders who are really good about teaching and helping you. Who were some of those?
Well, it was Phil Grove was there. Bill Lewis Jr. The Kratz boys, they were really good. And it was a bunch of others. I'd say 6 or 7 guys that were really good.
And then you mentioned the agent from Maryland came to take your book. Is that Steve Vonakis?
Yes. Well, in the summer, we were running a track called Hagerstown in the day. And then we needed to go back to Shenandoah Downs or Charlestown, whichever was running, at night. And this one day, I got lucky and won a couple at Hagerstown and a couple at, I think it was Charlestown that night. And I guess somebody had told the agent to come and watch. So we used to get home at midnight. My mother worked mutuals. My dad was then training a few horses and working valet. So we'd have a little something to eat at midnight and go to bed and start again the next day. And my agent knocked on the door and talked for a while. And after a few months, we got hooked up.
Were you excited about that opportunity of going to a bigger racetrack, or were you a little bit nervous at the time of leaving home?
Well, really, in the beginning, I never dreamt of leaving home. But that night, I told my dad, this might be a great opportunity. And he didn't think I was ready. So it all worked out, too.
But you went anyway. And where did you and Steve head to first?
We first left and went to Garden State in the fall of the year. And I won a few races. It was a short meet then. And I got hooked up with Pin Oak Stable. And they leased my contract. Because back then you had to have a contract. My dad held my contract. And they leased my contract for the Florida meet. So we left there and went to Old Tropical Park and Hialeah and Gulfstream. And then we came back to Garden State in the spring.
What was it like riding at these big tracks for the first time?
Well, It was the first time at an old tropical park they had what they called a tartan track. In other words, the grass course was rubber, like a rubber surface. And at the time, a lot of the top jocks didn't want to ride on it. They didn't feel that it was safe. So kind of gave an opportunity to somebody young, somebody eager. And I got lucky and won some races on that, and it kind of got me going.
Were there any riders there who also kind of helped you out?
Hey, back then it was, you know, greatest riders. They rode Bobby Ussery and Ray Broussard and Craig Peretz and Angel and Vasquez and Vasquez. And, you know, all those guys were 28, 30 years old. They were all in their prime. And that winter, I really learned a lot just watching and observing and listening. And then when we went to, when we come north to New Jersey in the spring, I felt like I was finally getting really tied on. I had won pretty good many races down there, but I was still making some mistakes.
Like what mistakes? Looking back.
I was trying to learn how to, I came from Charlestown, Shenandoah, where there's 3 mile races, half mile races at Charlestown, Hagerstown the same way. And, you know, it's like running and gunning, you know, try to get out of the gate as fast as you can, as far as they can run. I started to try to rate horses a little bit and, you know, finish a little better. And in the beginning, I was kind of holding them a little bit too tight instead of relaxing them back. And it took me a little bit of time, a few guys talking to me about it, and to gain the confidence that it works. And once I figured it out, real good things start happening.
Jimbo, when did you learn to use that great left stick that you built that reputation of having? You were such a good left-handed rider. When did you learn that?
I don't know. It's, some of the guys could do the same thing. Was it something you have to learn, something you have to figure out? And really, Angel Cordero showed me one time with a stick how to hold it better. And it made a big difference. Instead of just holding it with the palm of your hand, you got to put your thumb on it and guide it better. That made a big difference.
With hitting a horse left-handed, do you think that makes a difference too?
Hey, you got to be able to do it all, you know?
Right.
And in a race, you got to figure out what's going to make them give you that little bit more. Because sometimes it makes a difference. And especially on stretch runners, I used to try to wait real late. If I needed a little bit more to change something. And if that made a difference, it made a difference.
Joggy Jimbo Bocelli joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jimbo, as you mentioned, you went to New Jersey following the winter where you spent your time at Tropical Park, Hialeah, Gulfstream. You went to New Jersey, and you led the New Jersey circuit that year as an apprentice. Tell me what it was like riding there, and how quickly did you find that you were just taking off?
Well, it was really exciting. It was old Garden State. I thought there were great riders there, like Walter Blom, and I can go on and on. To name the jock seats, Marquez, You know, Ray Broussard was there. Don Brumfield was there. And pick up and do real good and have a really good meet and then go to Monmouth Park. I think I was the first apprentice ever to be leading rider at Monmouth Park. And we went to Atlantic City and I won that. So we were kind of on a roll. I thought I was, at the time, I thought I was getting pretty good. But when I look back, I still had, I don't know, a year or so to go before I thought. It takes time to really gain the confidence and to really feel comfortable and to know that every time you ride a horse, you're going to ride a really, really good race.
And why is that important, Jimbo, to have that confidence?
I was one of those guys that was really focused on my job. I got so I knew every horse at every track, how they performed good. If I wasn't riding them, I knew how to ride against them. And once you gain the confidence that you're going to really perform really good every single time, then you can really ride good. And it's sort of it's hard for a guy that only rides one or two horses a day to really perform 100% all the time. But when you have four or five good chances a day and you're riding six, seven, eight, nine every day, you can really focus and really really feel more comfortable. It's like a guy playing a whole football game or a guy that comes in for a play or two. Mm-hmm. You get into a rhythm. You get in, you know, a real good feel.
I always used to call it, Jimbo, when things are just going right and you're winning and you get in that zone, like you're so focused and, you know, everything that's going on, every rider around you, and it's such a good feeling to have that.
Well, I really feel like back in the 70s and 80s, you had jocks like Brumfield and Perrette and C.H. Marquez. They really worked at their job. They really stayed real focused. They knew if they didn't really perform that there were a bunch of other really good riders that would take their place. And I don't see it today. I do see it today. I don't see it as much. I don't see them really being focused going to the gate. I don't really see them having this real two or three game plans before the bell rings. I mean, you might be on a speed horse. If you don't have a game plan, if you get left at the gate, all of a sudden you panic. So you need to have two or three game plans going in so that you don't make any mistakes. So you must really focus before the race, going to the post, on two or three different options that possibly could happen. Say you're on a horse that looks like he's going to lay second and the speed horse gets left at the gate. You got to adapt, bam, like that. So all that's got to be in your mind. All that's got to be two or three scenarios figured out before it all happens. Then when it happens, you can react very easily.
What would you do, Jimbo, to prepare so well for a race? You mentioned you got to know every single horse on the grounds. So I'm sure you would also take a look at the racing form and handicap the race?
Well, naturally, you need to know your competition, but most riders have, like, certain patterns that, you know, they like to ride. Like, some of them like to sit third on the outside. Some of them like to go to the front. Some of them are going to leave there running. And then others, maybe they won't push the horse too much early and sit back and wait to make a run and sort of learn patterns that the guys you're riding with have. And like I said, those guys are really good. So when you're behind and as the race goes on, I could tell what they were thinking, what moves they were going to make, and I could make my run and figure it all out. I look nowadays at you know, some tracks and some races, jocks don't have, like, patterns like those guys did. You know, all of a sudden they'll be sitting behind four horses and boom, they swing out real quick where, you know, most guys would sit in there and try to get through or whatever.
What was your pattern, Jimbo, if you were, when you were riding back in the day, what were the other guys thinking about what you would be doing?
Well, you know, I always thought when you weigh out how good you were, it was like four or five categories to be considered really good. And naturally, you have to be able to ride a speed horse. Naturally, you have to be able to ride the turf. Naturally, you have to be able to ride a stretch runner. And you have to communicate with people really good, not only owners and trainers, but people that work on the backside. You have to make friends. You have to keep friends. And if somebody gets mad at you one day, hey, it's all over after that. You got to go in a couple days or the next day, and hey, it's all over. Because it's a small world there. If you get mad at everybody, gets mad at you, before long, there's nobody around that likes either one of you.
You got to turn the page, right, Jimbo?
But I always felt if I communicated really good with the people that worked with the horses, even though I might get beat on one, or maybe somebody wasn't satisfied with the way the horse ran that day, I didn't have a groom or a gallop boy or anybody take him off. You know, we were all friends. You know, we all worked together. And even today, I think it's a big, big part of it is for a jock to communicate and be friends with the outfit and the people that he's riding for.
Well, folks, we will continue our visit with Jockey Jimbo Bricelli after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Jimbo Bocelli. Jimbo, before we went to break, we were talking about how you just took off in New Jersey as an apprentice. And where did you go from there?
I dated a girl all through high school from when I was 15 and she was 13. And I was graduated a year before her, went away, and trying to go back home. So I came to Maryland, and we ended up getting married that winter, and we're still married 45 years.
Wow.
I always say the greatest accomplishment that I made as a jock was I was with the same wife the whole time and the same agent the whole time.
That's amazing.
Not too many jocks can say that.
Not too many can say that. Definitely not. That's incredible. That's incredible, Jimbo. And you and your wife, actually, you guys have several children. How many children do you have?
We had five girls.
Five girls.
All married, all graduated from college. I love all my son-in-laws. They're great. We do a lot together. We have so much fun. It ain't funny.
You should be a very proud father, Jimbo. And did any of them seek out careers at the racetrack?
I'm the only one.
The only one. They're smart, right?
Well, it worked out for me. They all have good jobs. They all treat my girls really good. Like I said, we have a lot of good times together. Grandkids are great. We have 12, so everything's working out pretty good.
12 grandkids, Jimbo. So now I have to ask, how old are you? I didn't know you were old enough to be a grandfather.
I'm 64.
64. 12 grandkids. That's amazing. That's awesome, Jimbo. So I also now want to talk about your resume is just ridiculous as far as quality of horses that you had the opportunity to ride. As I mentioned in the introduction, you rode the likes of Ruffian twice, two victories, Dave's Friend, Broad Brush, the list goes on and on. Who was your favorite horse?
I have to say Dave's Friend. I set five track records on him. 20-some stake wins. He was owned by great guy that I loved it. Is a franchise owner of Lido's Pizza. And now, after, 35 years, one of my daughters and my son-in-law own a Lido's franchise.
Really?
So it's really been neat.
Stayed in the family.
Well, he was really treated us good when we were young. We did a lot with he had a family with mostly boys. I had a family with mostly girls, and now the boys manage the franchise, and one of my daughters and her husband own one of the franchises, so it's pretty neat the way it works out.
Sounds like he had some good connections. Dave's Friend, and what was he like to ride?
I don't know. The first time I rode him, I was hurt, and I came out of the hospital. And in fact, Mr. Bell called me while I was in the hospital. He said, I was going to put this colt in. Do you think you can ride him? And I said, oh, my God, no way. So he said, well, I'll skip this maiden race and wait for the next one. And he won pretty easy, and he just kept on going from there. We thought he was going to be real good. We tried to stretch him out as a three-year-old, and I got beat on him in the Haskell at Monmouth Park. It was a really tough racetrack. It was deep mud, and I don't know, he only got beat the last 50 yards. Could have been maybe my fault a little bit, but he came out of the race with a little bit of a chip in his knee, so he had to take it out. And next year we started him back sprinting again. And in the beginning of Bowie in the winter, he won a couple in a row, but I didn't think he was really running top form. So we talked about a few things, and Mr. Bell said the only place we got to go was New York. And it just happened. The race had a lot of speed, and I drove the one hole. And I pretty much had to ride him the whole race instead of, you know, breaking real good and trying to save him and like I was doing, even though he was in front. And I had to I kept getting challenges the whole race. And he ran one of the biggest races he ever ran. So after that, I just used to ride him the whole race. And he learned how to read himself, I guess, and he just kept on winning. It was a shame one year, you know, back then they didn't have the Breeders' Cup. So he didn't get the chance to run in a race like that. Mm. But he pretty much beat everybody on the East Coast except this one horse, Plug Nickel. Won an allowance race at Saratoga, and then he beat me in the Carter, which was 7/8, and they gave that horse Sprinter of the Year that year. Mm. Even though Dave's friend had really carried over 130 pounds all year in every race, and I think that year he broke a track record that stood for 27 years at Aqueduct.
Wow.
He run 108 and some change. And he got beat out for Sprint of the Year.
Was that track record still hold at Aqueduct?
I'm not sure, but I set track records at Laurel from 5/8 to Pimlico. He broke the track record at a mile and an eighth as a three-year-old.
Wow. Quite
And in between, he set a record at Philadelphia Park. I know he set a record after Mr. Bell sold him at the track in Arizona. Same thing with Turf Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
He was really good. Really, really good horse. He showed up every time. Carried the weight where nowadays, you know, pretty much everybody carries similar weight. Within 4 or 5 pounds anyway. But, you know, he'd start out the year 130-some pounds, and by the end of the year, 138, and pretty much beat everybody he brought to him. He was a tough one.
Wow.
And like I said, he was owned by a good friend. And I was kind of around the horse my whole, you know, ever from word go. We knew he was going to be pretty good. We didn't know how good. And he stuck around for a while, so that was a lot of fun.
Understandable.
And a lot of people used to follow him.
Yeah, understandable why he is your favorite, Jimbo. But tell me a little bit about a Ruffian, how you got them out aboard her.
I was in New York that year. I was under contract with Green Tree, and I was kind of an early bird at the track in the morning, so I would stop by all the guys that started real early first, and Frank Whiteley was one of them. And I tried to stop by every day. Didn't hardly use me that much, even breezing horses or anything. But one day he said, maybe you can breeze a horse with Jacinto. I said, yeah, and so he put me on a pretty nice horse that had just won. It was an older horse that just won a stake sprinting. And we're breezing two horses together. And the other one was a little better than mine. And when we pulled up, I go, holy mackerel, this horse that I'm on just won a stake. I asked Jacinto, I said, who the hell are you on? He said, there's only a two-year-old filly. And we're going like, holy hell. Mm. I said, well, what's her name? He said, Franklin, tell nobody. Anyway, she ran the first time, and the big field at Belmont. I was there. I didn't ride the race. We're watching, and first jump out of the gate, she kind of got off a little slow. And I went, damn. I looked down at the ground and back to the TV. And I looked back in 2 seconds, she was going to the lead already. Mm. She was something else.
And Jacinto was serving days, I guess.
Yeah, he got sat down. And I was, that morning I was at Mama Park breezing a horse called Hudson County that just finished second in the Preakness. And I was supposed to ride him. And I got a, back then there were no cell phones, so I got a page. When I called back, Mr. Waitley said, you can be at Belmont Park before 12 o'clock. Stop at my barn, I want to talk to you. And that's where, left Mama at 9 in the morning and drove to Belmont where I was going to ride that day. He asked me if I wanted to ride her, and I said, I'll do my best. So it all worked out pretty good.
I'd say it did. And didn't Jacinto led you to post?
Yeah, one of the days he did. One of the two times.
Yeah.
The other time we were at Saratoga, and to be honest with you, I never really had a real good meet at Belmont Park. I mean, I did okay, but not nearly as good as Aqueduct or Saratoga. And we were going to Saratoga, and I was trying to, generate some interest, maybe. And I schooled a jumper for Sydney Waters. And I was thinking about riding a jumping race just to, create some excitement. Hey, I'm still here, But Frank Whiteley evidently found out. He called me over the next day and he goes, oh, I heard you schooled a jumper. I said, yeah, I was thinking about riding one. This is a pretty nice horse Sydney Waters has, and he'll have a good chance. And he said, if I ever see you on a jumper again at Saratoga, you're not sitting behind Jacinto anymore on Ruffian. Mm. So I go, okay. And sure enough, a couple of days later, he got set down again at Saratoga, and I got to ride her again in the spinaway.
So worked out. It was definitely worth not riding the jumpers to ride her in the spinaway.
Well, anyway, it was really exciting. I was young at the time, maybe my third year. I had a pretty good year in New York, my first year. Like I said, I was under contract with Green Tree, and we had Stop the Music and Hatchet Man and Shredder and Porthole and a lot of other ones that were really good. So I had a really good year with them, but I never, I shouldn't say never, but I hadn't really been in that huge Super Bowl atmosphere before, and that was really the first time. Everything else was just another race, Mm-hmm. But when you come out of the paddock and three of them on grandstand at Saratoga, is giving the horse a standing ovation, you, through your mind, it's like, oh, my God, what if something goes wrong? So now you're going over all these scenarios, if I stumble leaving the gate or if I get off bad or, lucky nothing happened bad. I mean, she took care of everything, so it worked out really good.
I'd say it did, Jimbo. She led wire to wire that day in the spinaway. And you had her pretty cranked down, I heard, that she went in 108, and that was just pretty impressive how easily she won that day.
Well, I think one of the reasons Mr. Whiteley rode me was I rode a little longer than most of the guys were there. I think he thought that that would be better for her. And I thought she ran really, really top races both times that I rode her. Not that it was me at all, but I felt we were real comfortable together.
Juggy Jimbo Bracelli joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jimbo, how about the 1986 Kentucky Derby? You were.
I don't want to talk about it.
You don't want to talk about it?
No, you know, hey, look, there's a bunch of years when you're doing real good that people call and ask if you can ride not only the Kentucky Derby, but the races. And we were pretty much based here at that time in Maryland. And especially Kentucky Derby Day, because it's 20-horse field and a lot of jocks, you know, go to ride the Derby. A lot of good horses open up in stakes all over the country. So I always felt unless I could go to the Kentucky Derby and really think I could win it, it never really interests me that much. So this one year, I mean, Broad Brush, he was a really tough, tough horse to ride. He won the General George and then the Tessio and then the Jim Beam and then the Wood Memorial, and he was getting good. And we really went there, me and Dickie Small. We went there thinking we could win it. And that was pretty exciting. Horse breathed real good before we left here. Horse was going real good. We thought if we had a real good trip, we had a real good chance to win. And for somebody that's really in the Derby or you're really at top stage, when you get to the Derby, usually there's really only four or five people that really think they can win it. Some horses are tailing off. Some of them aren't eating too good. You know, they've had hard races. They have some problems, and but there's always a few that really, really like their horse. And Charlie Willingham really liked his horse that year. She really liked him. They thought they could win it. And as it went, we didn't think our horse ran his A1 race that day for some reason. He got really tired. I had a hard time getting him into a rhythm. He was missing strides early. Finally settled down, and I thought he ran good, but he didn't run his number one race that day. But he only got beat a length or so. It was a great experience to go there and think he could win it. And I never got back again thinking I could win it, but it was really a lot of fun. It was really an experience.
You mentioned that he was tough to ride. How so?
Like most horses, you give them a command and they respond, or you ask them, the good ones anyway, you ask them to slow down a little bit, they slow down a little bit. By the time they get to those kind of races, they're pretty experienced and pretty controllable. But I never could figure out what he was thinking. Like I'd ask him to move and he wouldn't move. I'd ask him to move and he wouldn't move. And then all of a sudden, when I back off for five or six strides, boom, he would move on his own. And it was just really hard to gauge. He didn't want to hit the front too quick, because if he hit the front, he was waiting on other horses. And I got lucky a few times. He won the Jim Beam just by a little bit. I might have hit the front a little bit too early, and he was kind of shutting it down. And he should have won the Wood Memorial by 15 lengths. He won by two or three, and he was shutting it down. And And in the Derby, it was, you know, I was kind of pushed from behind to move a little early, and he hit the lead at the top of the stretch, but we were all together there, and he just didn't finish quite as good as he usually did.
What was it like riding for Dickie Small? He, one of the best people, he was the first person who gave me a shot in Maryland, and of course, such a sad thing, he recently passed away, but what was it like riding for Dickie Small?
I always say one of the luckiest things in my riding career was riding for guys that we really liked each other. Like, we worked together with horses to try to make them better. We won some sick races with horses that were just horses to try to, you know, breeze them the right way and get in the right race. And we kind of had the same feel about a horse. And it was just fun to be around him. He's not only a great guy, he was a great horseman. And really liked to work together to get it all done right. Rod Rush was one of the toughest ones we ever worked with. He, one morning I worked him, and he made the top of the stretch gap at Pimlico, and we worked him with two other horses to get him around, and some of the works didn't go 100%. But once we got it all together in the spring of the year and got him going real good, that's when he got good. And he, you know, won 4 or 5 in a row, and he just kept on going after that.
Made the gap on the racetrack while you're trying to work him. Yeah, that doesn't sound like fun.
If he wasn't with it, you know, Dickie used to gallop him with a filly. He was a stud, and he would stay with the filly and gallop, but if you tried to get him around the racetrack galloping by himself, he wasn't going to do it. So they had a filly called Flux and Flow that really never did that great as a runner, but she could gallop him to death. And he would stay right with her, side by side, and never leave her side. So he really worked at the horse to make him good. That horse had some problems, and he worked with all that, and he stuck around. And he did a lot more after me, after, they used other jockeys, too.
Well, Jimbo, we only have 5 minutes left here to the show. I can't believe how fast time's flying by. I think we could talk for a lot longer here. But I want to ask you, as I mentioned, you had such a long, illustrious career. And you decided to retire riding at the age of 37, which for some jockeys, that's fairly young. Some go on to ride until, you know, early 50s or so. Why did you make the decision to retire?
Well, there's a lot of things that went into it. First of all, I had 5 girls playing sports. I was missing a lot of it. They were all good athletes. I never, I shouldn't say I didn't like to ride, because I did like to ride. I never was really into the owner kind of deal. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it this way. I watched the Larry Bird, Magic Johnson editorial, I guess you call it. And Magic Johnson was the jock that was out there, you know, dealing with the owners and the people and, you know, having fun. And Larry Bird was the guy that kind of sat in the background and played basketball. And I was somewhat that way in that I rode the races. I wasn't really good with the people, with the owners. In fact, like I told you, I knew every horse on every track. When I look back, it's hard for me to remember the owners' names that owned them. I knew the trainer. I knew the groom. I knew the horse. I knew his blinkers, his bit. I knew it all. But the owner thing, I never got into. And I don't know. There was a bunch of things that I was hurt. And I really want to say to this day, when I see Mike Smith, when I see Gary Stevens and numerous other jocks still competing at high level at 50 years old, man, I pat them on the back. It's not easy to do. It's not easy to do at all.
How was that transition, Jimbo? Did you find that you missed it?
I didn't miss it at all. You know, once I made my decision, there were some other things I wanted to do. I've always had, a very small stable, me and a buddy of mine, and we always, do fairly good. And I kind of got into farming. Originally I was buying farms and rehabbing them, like people buy a house and rehab it and then resell it. And I've had five big farms, make them nice horse farms, maybe stay and raise my kids for 8 or 10 years and get another one and do it all again. And I like baling the hay. I got a little hay and straw business at the racetrack, and just mostly for guys that I've known all my life. Amy Smith, Steve Casey, Huron McGee, guys like that. And
well, Jimbo, we are all out of time. I hate to cut you off there, but sounds like you have a lot of great things going on. We are wishing you all of the best, and thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dalla Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.